Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, welcome back to the Commentary Track. This is episode 27, and they said it wouldn't last. I'm your host, Frank Thompson, who struggles to save humanity at the prescription counter of a pharmacy still technically owned by my father. Got a good show for you today. Before we get to it, I got a couple of things I want to mention. One old movie related, one new movie related. Because we're an inclusive podcast here. We let them all in. You don't have to be able to pay admission. Just show up at the door, old movie or new movie, and we'll let you in. We'll hold out the hand of welcome. There is in the theaters this very moment, as I record this, which is in January of 2013, a movie called Jack Reacher. Now, this is based on a series of novels. I guess it's based, the movie is based on one specific novel, but there's a series of novels by an author whose pen name is Lee Child. And I enjoy these novels. They have a main character named Jack Reacher. And let me read how Lee Child describes Jack Reacher. This is in the most recent book, A Wanted Man. So it's a 2012 book. So this is a book that was published while this movie was in production. Maybe it was even written while this movie was in production. And this is how Lee Child describes his main character. Reacher was a big man, 6'5" tall, heavily built, and that night, as always, he looked a little ragged and unkempt. Okay. In other books, we learn that Jack Reacher cuts his own hair. He only wears clothes long enough for them to get too dirty or too worn out, and then he throws them away and buys another set of clothes. He owns nothing, and he's huge and scarred and beat up, and everybody who sees him is a little taken aback by this hulk of a man. So, who did they cast to play him in the movie? Some giant of a fella? Did they get Robbie Coltrane? Did they get Brett Gelman? I don't know. No. They got Tom Cruise. Now, I haven't seen the movie yet, and I really hope that I can walk into this movie with an open mind. I plan on seeing it tomorrow, in fact, and I'll report back if I have anything worthwhile to say about it. But, geez Louise, I mean, I like Tom Cruise. I got nothing against Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise in a good Tom Cruise movie is just fine with me. Tropic Thunder, terrific. But as Jack Reacher, no. This is like casting Clark Gable to play Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. This is a bad choice. Anyway, I don't know what I intend to solve by saying this and by moaning about this, because the movie's already made. There's nothing I can do about it. It's out. It's done. Lee Child is undoubtedly a richer and happier man. But I got to tell you, if somebody took one of my characters from one of my books, and believe me, that is highly unlikely to ever happen. But man, oh man, if it was cast like that, I would at least be disturbed. Now, granted, I might have made such a boatload of money that it wouldn't disturb me for long, because I am a shallow, shallow human being. But man, this has really been sticking in my craw for a while, ever since I heard about this. And again, let me stress, Tom Cruise, you seem like a swell guy. Good actor, got nothing against you at all. If we meet on the street, I will offer you a hearty hand clasp. But Jack Reacher, no. No. On a happier note, I want to announce that for the first time since I've had this Commentary Track podcast, I've actually done a new Commentary Track. It's been actually a couple of years since I've done a Commentary Track. I think the last one was Objective Burma, which was probably 2 years ago, maybe even more. That's a long time between Commentary Tracks. Used to do them all the time. But the business seems to be changing. The DVD manufacturers don't tend to go for them as much as they used to. And so it's slimmer and slimmer pickings. But I recently did one for the 1932 film White Zombie, starring Bela Lugosi, Madge Bellamy, and others. And this is a restoration from a 35-millimeter print that was struck from the original negative in the 1960s. As far as I know, the original negative is gone. And so this is probably the best way to get as close to the source as possible. It was given a great deal of digital cleanup. And when I was doing the commentary track and was watching it on the monitor, I thought it looked terrific. There are people who have different opinions about what a digitally remastered film should look like. And I gather there's quite a debate going on about this one. But the Holland Entertainment Group, who did this remastering, did something I think was very shrewd in order to try to make everybody happy. Now, you can't make everybody happy, but they tried. And that is, they took the original mastering of that 35-millimeter print that was found, with all of its scratches and splices, but with all of the original grain and the original image and everything just like it should look, and put that on the disc as well. So you can have the digitally cleaned up version, which I think looks very nice, or you can watch the version straight from the original print with nothing done to it at all. So that seems like win-win to me. And then you add the commentary track by moi. That's French for me. And I think it makes a fun thing. There's also a little interview with Bela Lugosi and a trailer and all sorts of stuff. It's just a cool disc. Now, if you were to be inclined to buy White Zombie, I have to again sadly inform you that I will make nothing from this thing. So my plug is simply as a matter of general information to the public at large that this is out there. But the one way you can make it benefit me in a little bit is to go to the link on my website, thecommentarytrack.com, or on my personal website, frankthompson.tv, and you'll see an Amazon link to White Zombie. Just click on that, and when you buy it through Amazon through my sites, then I'll get a little bit of kickback from Amazon, and that is sweet. I mean, it's a tiny kickback, a really minuscule kickback. Nevertheless, I'm happy to have it. So, White Zombie, yay. Jack Reacher, we'll see. But the old and the new comes together on the commentary track. That should be my new motto. Now, today's episode is with a really great film historian, Hugh Munro Neely. I've known Hugh for quite a while, been an admirer of his documentary films and the work that he's done on silent film in general, but not only silent film. But Hugh and I have connected on several levels, also music. He studied to be a conductor, and I studied arranging and composition in college when I went to Berklee College of Music in Boston. And so we have that, and we have a lot of mutual friends, and this is the first time I'd ever sat down to talk with him in any real depth. And believe me, I could have gone on for a long time. Now, I know I say that a lot, but I do mean it. I get people on this commentary track podcast who I really like to talk to and who are good talkers and who really have something interesting to say. And so it has not yet come up that I've gotten to the end of an interview and thought, wow, I'm glad that's over with. Every single time I thought, I got more to talk with this person about, and that's certainly the case with Hugh Neely. And so he will be back. Don't know when, but it will happen. And if for no other reason than for me to be able to go back to his house, which is a great place, way up on top of a hill in a quite rural area, and it's beautiful out there, and my wife and I had a great Sunday drive to go up to visit him and his family, and it was great fun. So I hope that you will enjoy this. my talk with Hugh Monroe Neely, and we'll talk about this and that, and then I will see you on the other side. Always begin at the beginning. That's my motto. So were you always interested in films?
I always loved film, but I was not heavy into film history like I am now for the longest time. My first love was music, classical music, and that's where I started. But when I was a kid, I loved to write. I loved writing stories. I loved writing essays. I loved photography, and I loved music. And I guess it just took me a while to find something to put all three of those arts together.
Well, silent film certainly does have a need for music, so...
Yes, which is important because I've been lucky enough to be involved in, over the years, in scoring some silent films, not as a composer. I don't compose, but I work with composers, and when we have had orchestral presentations or recordings, I have my secret history as an orchestra conductor, and so I get to conduct them some of the time.
And didn't you say you studied conducting?
I studied conducting. I studied violin, viola. But I was actually a music education major in high school, in college. I was going to teach little kids how to play C major scales on the trumpet. And it didn't last.
Well,
I finally decided there were other things that were more interesting.
It's an honorable profession. But
absolutely.
Yes.
Well, my mother was a teacher. My father was a teacher. So I come from a line of people who do that kind of thing.
Well, in a way, making documentary films is
a kind of
teaching, in a way. Sure.
Yes.
Oh, well, tell me how you made the turn then, if you started out as a musician or started out doing other things.
I had done a variety of things. I studied music education in college, but then didn't end up using it. And I ended up in a... working in a professional photo lab, because that was one of my other histories, doing art level black and white printing and film processing. And then I started my own photo lab for a number of years, had a lab in Santa Monica. But I found that after about 2 years or 3 years, I was getting very tired of being in the dark all day. And get in the dark in movie theaters a lot, but be in the dark all day doing nothing but printing other people's photographs on Cibachrome was getting kind of dull, and I wanted something else. And around that time, a friend of mine called me up and said, oh, I'm working in a documentary film company, which surprised me because I had never been aware he was involved with that kind of stuff before, but he said, come on over here and work for me. And I did. And it turned out the organization was a company called Aviation Audiovisual Library, which was run by Ferdy Groffé Jr., the son of the composer.
Wow.
Who was himself a filmmaker of sort of grade B-minus, or I should say budget B-minus movies. But he had done a number of independent films, some of which were rather inventive. But what he was doing right then... he and his partner, Keith, were involved in getting public domain documentary films that had been made by the U.S. government. As anything the U.S. government makes, of course, naturally, unless there's something they've worked their way around, it isn't in the public domain. So he would get those from libraries at Air Force bases and places like that. And Ferdy loved aviation. He was fascinated with aviation. And so there were a lot of documentaries that had been made by the War Office during World War II, about how the fighting 14th Air Force or, the Thunderbolt in Italy or the P-51 Mustang over Germany. And he got those films and he released, had them transferred to video. And this was in the early days of home video, when the average VHS retail price was around $89.
Sure.
And he was able to cut them down real cheap, only $49 or $59 or $69, and sell them via, mail order. And he made quite a success for himself for a number of years, selling mail order productions of old documentaries that he would put together two or three or four films on a tape and give it a new snazzy title and have some new artwork made and put it out. And for a while, he was the only one doing it. So I came in around the time that he was starting to get some competition. There were other companies starting to see and do the same thing. And I initially started my grand introduction to documentary filmmaking was writing the newsletter that he put out every month, using the adjectives that he was inclined to use, which were, gut-wrenching excitement as we, battle the Nazis with the Fifth Air Force, something like that. And I wrote the newsletter, and I started editing for him, which meant just compiling these things together. But eventually they sent me to a little video editing school that Sony used to run up at the AFI buildings. And I studied video editing back in the linear days of video editing with 3/4-inch U-matic machines, which we now consider to be ancient history. And I learned that and started to make my own documentaries for them, because after a while they started to run out of films that they could release. And so we took a look at the catalog. At that point he'd had hundreds of films, literally, that he'd acquired over the years. And we decided, well, now, most of the people who buy these things love aviation history, and they love a particular plane. They all, flew in a B-17. These are veterans now who are, have the money to shell out for these $49 tapes. And they all love the B-17, or they all love the P-51, so why don't we take all the pictures we have, all the film we have of, say, a P-51, and then we'll make a documentary about how the P-51 won the war. And when we get done with that, we'll take all the film we have of the P-47, and we'll say about how the P-47 won the war. And we kept going for a number of years with that sort of a structure, creating these little documentaries that were made without the benefit of actually going out and interviewing anyone. They were all voice of God narration, soup to nuts. But you got all this incredibly exciting footage, and we put together some new music to it, and we told the stories that seemed like they would be popular. And that was interesting, but I came from a love of film and history and theater and music, not from a fascination with war history. And so I got kind of tired of it after a while. And besides, how many times can you win World War II?
Well, how many planes are there?
Well, we did it for a while, like I said. And I wanted to find something else. And luckily, around that time, we did get involved in some other things. We started to do some stuff for U.S. News World Report, and then for A&E. And this is before there was a History Channel, but this is when some people used to refer to A&E as the World War II channel, because they had so many old documentaries on. And they wanted us to create some new ones for them. So we did that for a while. And then eventually I switched direction and found another company that was doing some A&E biographies. And I was lucky enough to get them to let me write the biography of Thomas Jefferson. That was the standard A&E biography of Thomas Jefferson for many years. And I edited a whole bunch of them, particularly the one on Michelangelo and one on George Washington and one on Susan B. Anthony. So we had a good time with those for a few years. And then I moved on for about a year working on a syndicated, I guess you would call it a reality series called U.S. Customs Classified, Real Stories of the U.S. Customs Service. And that was kind of fun. We did 22 episodes of that where I was editing mostly, and I would do a little bit of rewriting on the scripts, because quite often they would get in their interviews, and they would get in their surveillance footage, which was supposed to be a big thing. There was supposed to be a lot of surveillance footage. Well, there was only a little bit of surveillance footage and a lot of stuff that was shot to look like surveillance footage.
So was this reenactments?
Yeah. And then they would do reenactments with actors. And very often, and it was actually a fascinating show, but what you learned was that these U.S. Customs stories, the major investigations that they did for the U.S. Customs Service, often went on for 6 months or a year or 2 years. And these stories, they would fit like 4 to 6 of them in an hour. So they had to be boiled down to about 10 to 15 minutes, usually. and some of them down to, you know, 5 to 7 minutes. So by the time you got it all done, very often the story as condensed by the writer didn't fit the story that was told by the people in the interviews. And so you had to do, in editing it, somebody had to do a bit of rewriting in order to make it all fit. So I got to do a little bit of that and work there. And then after that, after we did that series, went on for a year and almost got picked up, but not quite. It was syndicated and they did apparently very well in metropolitan areas, but they didn't do it in the center of the country. In Kansas and Oklahoma, people really didn't seem to care as much about the U.S. Customs Service. So the show did some very good in some markets and not so well in others. So that ended, and around that time, my old friend Keith came up and said, you know, I'm working with the Mary Pickford Foundation now, and I think that we could start a documentary film company of working on the history of silent films and do it. They, you know, they really need a documentary done on Mary Pickford, and there hasn't been one since the 70s. And this was about 1995 or early 96. I think it was 1995 when we started doing that. And the very first thing we did, we started that company. And the very first thing we did, that's Timeline Films, which is still my company today. And the very first thing we did was a documentary on Charles Buddy Rogers.
Hmm.
And Buddy was still alive at that point. He lived until 1999.
Sure.
And he was just a charming guy, a really, really sweet fellow. And so
and this was 95?
This was around 95 we started working on it. I think we finished it in 96. And I'm terrible with years. I have to go look them up. I'll give you the approximate.
So we interviewed him the same year
uh-huh.
for the Wellman documentary.
Ah.
And I'm curious to hear what your experiences were. And then
well, that was an interesting thing. We decided to do, he was pretty, I mean, the whole reason for doing this documentary was Buddy would go out to these dinners and these various events and where he had given money or, you know, made a donation. There was some kind of event that would be honoring him or honoring, you know, the topic for which he had given money. And he would try and get up and give a speech. And as time went on, it was getting harder for him to do that, to get up and give a speech. So we came up with the idea that, well, maybe we could make a short film about his life, and then they could show the film, and all he would have to do would be to wave. Hi, how you doing? Glad to be here, you know. And so we wanted to do that, but he was at a point where anything that took much time was tiring him out a bit. So my partner, got a whole bunch of interviews that he had done previously, over the years, print interviews and things like that. Not anything on camera or even on audio, but he wrote a script for him, based on those interviews that we could then have him speak.
Mm.
So the idea originally was that we would take the camera in and we would, he also wasn't sure how he would do on that. And I plotted out in the film exactly the spots that I wanted to see him on camera. So we figured all we had to do was get him to do a couple of sentences for each story on camera, and the rest of it would be voiceover. And we could take our time recording that. And that part, the voiceover, worked out very well, but there was a trick to it. We brought him the script. And he said, oh, did I do this? Oh, yeah, that's pretty interesting. Okay. And because his memory was, you know, he had most of his stories.
Sure.
But his memory was not as good as it had been a few years earlier. And what I found was when we gave him the script to read, the first thing he would do is he would go through it. He says, I grew up as a little boy in Olathe, Kansas, and I went, my father ran the newspaper there. And then when we said, okay, Buddy, it's time to do a take now, he'd say, I grew up as a little boy in Olathe, Kansas, and my father ran the newspaper there. And it was just a little too much. In fact, maybe it was more than a little too much. And we tried to figure out what we're going to do. But then I went back and listened to it when he was first reading through it, before he was performing it.
Mm-hmm.
And the first read-through was wonderful. And so we did the whole thing just as we were going to do it. And in the end, I think about 90% of the time, I used his first read-through where he was just practicing or just, you know, reading what was there on the page so he could get to know it. And it actually sounded very nice. It sounded very warm. It sounded very human. There was a bit of memory, because sometimes it would spark a memory in his head, and that was very charming, and it worked out very well. But we didn't use the great performance, at least most of the time.
Sure.
And then we had the giant disaster. We had, you know, we were doing this thing on a shoestring, of course. It was our first project. And the company I had been doing the A&E biographies for owned a camera. And we figured that we would get that camera, borrow that camera, and shoot it. And so I had a whole plan, because we were only going to shoot little bitty sections of him at Picfair Lodge, his home in Beverly Hills, mm-hmm. the one that was just down the hill from Picfair.
Sure.
And so we wanted to look as nice as possible, so we went and we got a dolly, and we got we worked out exactly how we're going to filter it, and we're going to shoot all this. These little sections, I think it was about 7 or 8 sections that we were going to shoot, each one in a different location. And we spent a day doing it. And the camera had just come back from the repair shop. So I figured, great, it's going to be in top shape, everything's going to be perfect. We shot on Betacam SP. And my DP, after the first setup, rewound it and checked the tape and saw, everything's there. It looks beautiful. So we shot all day long. We had our 6 or 7 setups. He seemed to have a good time doing it, but I was told later that he was very tired afterwards. We had a great shoot. Got back, and I put the tapes up on the edit system, and after that first tape, that first take that we had checked, there was nothing there. Or rather, I should say, there was audio, but no video. And I had never seen a problem like that, where there was, in fact, audio, but no video recorded onto the tape. And it wasn't a clean black, like, you know, somebody left a lens cap on. It was just a big, mushy mess, Jeez. Except that you could hear the audio. And it turned out that when a camera at the repair shop had been reassembled, they had shoved a little card in place, and that when they did that, it had pinched a little wire, and that wire lasted until we moved the camera from the first setup to the second setup, and that's when it busted. And I was absolutely devastated, and I called up, Beverly, who was Buddy's second wife, who was his caretaker for the last years of his life, and she said, no, we cannot reshoot. This took too much out of him. He's too tired. I don't want him to have to go through it again. So we did the documentary, and we used his voice, and he told all the stories, but you only see him talking on camera once. We did go down to his home in Palm Springs, and we did shoot some more stuff of him playing around on the piano. We shot some stuff of him, and that was the funny thing, because he moved, you know, like a little old man, because he mm-hmm. was a little old man.
Sure.
Well, he's a tall old man, but he had these sort of hunched shoulders, and he was getting, you know, very weak. But I'll tell you, that man, that he loved golf, and I wanted to get a picture of him with his golf clubs. And the home in the Palm Springs area was right on the right on a green, so we sent him out with the golf clubs and stayed back with the camera just for a little B-roll of Buddy, you know, shooting golf. And that little old man sort of walked a little crunchy walk out to the spot in the green where he set down the tee and put the golf ball on the tee, pulled out the clubs, straightened up, swung way back, and swung full force, and knocked that ball somewhere all the way down the way, I think. As soon as he had that golf club in his hand, he was a different man.
Wow.
So he was fun. I enjoyed him immensely. I talked to a lot of people because, you know, we were doing this. This was a sort of essentially a puff piece or a something that would be nice about him. But I also wanted to learn, you know, who is this guy? What's he about? Couldn't find anybody anywhere that wanted to say a bad thing about him. No. Now, you could find people who would talk about whether or not he was completely heterosexual or not. That could be another issue. But you couldn't find anybody who would say a bad thing about Buddy. He was the – and I came to believe that truthfully because it seemed likely when he was alive. But after he passed away, I talked to Beverly a number of times. And she was just devastated. She was devastated by the loss. And no question in my mind that he meant a tremendous amount to her. And that second marriage was, at least as far as she was concerned, an absolutely real marriage and a real, she had great, great love and fondness for him.
Well, she definitely took great care of him. Mm-hmm. And I remember when we went to interview him at the lodge, she was not particularly tickled that we were there, and
she was very protective.
He had a butler. It's the first butler I ever saw, I think. And
the Oriental fellow?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember his name.
I can't, yeah.
I should.
I remember him visually very well, but
there's a little bit of Gloria Swanson, sensibility.
Eric von Stroheim.
He apparently had at one point in time, I met him, what was his name? And he had been, he told me, yes, I was a director of photography.
Yeah.
And he had his old light meter still, and he had a number of other things.
We were doing a documentary on William Wellman, mm-hmm. and Bill Jr. was one of the exec producers on it, of course. And he was there, and they had worked on a picture together, he and the butler. And I can remember throughout the interview, a couple of times, phone would ring. The butler would go over and pick it up and say, "No, they're still here." And then we were packing up. The phone rang one time, and he said, "They're packing up. They're leaving as fast as they can." But so,
Wilson, I think Wilson Hong. I think
Yeah.
Very nice, and very helpful guy. Very nice guy.
And but he was, and he would kind of shrug at us and go, you know, do what you need to do, but she was not pleased that we were there. Well,
Beverly was very protective.
Yeah.
And she, and I don't think I learned, as I said, the full amount of how much she cared for him until after he was gone, and she still carried that torch for a long time.
But I wish we had thought about what you did for getting his interviews, because he didn't remember much of anything. And so what I would do, the director of the film was doing the questioning, but I would sit next to Buddy right outside camera range, and I'd say, "Well, you remember you were in the cockpits," and then the cameraman would duck down and you would do this, and he'd say, "Oh, yeah, and then he would say it,
mm-hmm.
and he was great, he was fine, but he had to be reminded about everything, so, but that was late. I mean, that was 95,
oh,
so
yes.
It was late in his life. So.
Well, he was well into his 90s.
Yeah. And so, but the film, your film turned out okay?
Our film turned out okay. Not very many people have seen it because it was never released commercially or broadcast. It was about 27 minutes long. I'm still very fond of it. And every once in a while I pull it out and sell a few DVD art copies or something like that. But it hasn't been seen. But it made our company because we showed it. It was our first real production, and we showed it at a meeting of a Screen Smart Set. Do you remember the Screen Smart Set?
No.
If I remember correctly, it was the mothers of movie stars.
Interesting.
I think I've got that right. And they would have meetings regularly. They did charitable work, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a screening of My Best Girl, and we showed the documentary before the film, and Buddy was there, of course. And after the film, somebody came up to me and said, "There's somebody wants to meet you." And I said, "Okay, great." And it was Roddy McDowall, who had been in the audience. And he said, "I really loved what you did. And if there's any way I can help you in your work, just let me know." And 9 times out of 10, when somebody says something like that, I just tongue-tied. I have no way of, I don't respond, you know, I come up with the perfect request a few minutes later, but for some reason or other, at that moment, right on the tip of my tongue, I said, well, then you can narrate my next documentary. And that started a wonderful relationship. Indeed, he did narrate our next documentary, which was a film called Star Power on the creation of United Artists. But in addition to that, I think he was very helpful in getting us narrators for the Louise Brooks and documentary, the Barry Pickford documentary. And he was a great, great guy, tremendously helpful. We could call him up for advice anytime. We lost him much, much too soon.
Oh, yeah.
And I really miss him. I wish we had somebody like him around today.
I might be the last person to ever write a script that Roddy McDowall performed.
Ah.
Because he was... I worked for American Movie Classics for about 10 years writing intros mm-hmm. whenever they would have guest hosts. And so they had... They were going to be doing the Planet of the Apes films.
Oh, yes.
And they had Charlton Heston, Roddy McDowall, and, oh, her name just went out of my head, Streetcar Named Desire, Kim Hunter.
Yeah, yes.
As the three hosts, but they were going to be introducing all of the films at one point or another, so I had to write different intros for all of them. But I remember that day with Roddy McDowall, and he kept, his back was in excruciating pain, and he just kept having to go lie down. But he was incredibly nice and very professional and just great to work with. But he was in pain, and he kept saying, well, I'm going to the spa or something. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, he didn't talk about being ill.
No, we didn't know then, but he was dead very soon after that. I think it came out that he had... the cancer right very soon before he died. I mean, it just days. So I treasure that little memory of working with him the one time. But
well, we interviewed him again after did the narration for Star Power. We interviewed him for the Louise Brooks documentary because he had known Louise slightly.
Mm-hmm.
And we interviewed him for the Mary Pickford documentary because, of course, he had known Mary also. And we had... He was very, very helpful, but I do remember when we did the voiceover for that piece on United Artists. We had a great time doing it. Went very smooth. He took, I think, all of my suggestions until we got to the end, and he gave the very ending line of the documentary a little twist in the way he read it, so that it ended in an up. It ended, you know, kind of hanging in the air. And I said, oh, that's very interesting. But would you mind giving us a second take where you do the traditional, now we're finished with our story, you know, kind of a down mm-hmm. ending? He said, no, I don't think so. I said, well, just give us an alternate. That would be fun. He said, no, I thought about this a lot, and I think I want to do it this way. Trust me, you'll like it. And I did.
Well, what could you say? Sure. He knows. If he doesn't know,
he knew.
Does.
Oh, absolutely. He was a pro.
Now, just to move back a step, before you started working on the Buddy Rogers, this was the first film-related documentary that you'd worked on.
That's right. Or
movie, Hollywood-related.
Yeah.
But had you ever had a particular interest in silent film, or was it something that ever really came up in your life?
I loved movies from when I was very, very young. And to this day, I'm afraid that a lot of my movie education came between the ages of about 8 and 16, mm-hmm. when I would come home from school and sit down for what they called the early show on television at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I watched almost everything. Of course, I was a kid. I was young. I liked the adventure films, and I liked the, you know, some of the things that were mysteries and stories. Not as much the social dramas, like the comedies, but I loved films. I really liked looking them up, and I got my very first copy of Leonard Maltin's book, you know, with a, it's a 3-star, it's a 4-star, great, or 3.5 stars, that's good. And I would move around and watch the films on, you know, Channel 9 and Channel 11 and Channel 13. And I found the Channel 11 seemed to, KTTV, I think it was, used to, at least at the time I was watching, really took care in what they picked. They were showing a better class of film regularly. But I got a lot of my education of films from the 30s and 40s and 50s there on television in the 60s and 70s, mostly the 60s.
Sure.
And when I was in college, I started to branch out and go see things. And that was, of course, that sort of golden age we had for a number of years of little art house theaters and places that repertory theaters. You know, the Fox Venice and the wonderful, what's the one over near Hoover on Wilshire? Started with a Vagabond, the Vagabond Theater.
Yeah.
Always 35 millimeter prints.
I forgot about the Vagabond, yeah.
Yes. And I would go out to a lot of those, you know, on weeknights or times when I could. And if Charles Chaplin or Kevin Thomas wrote in the L.A. Times, go to this film. You must see this film if you are serious about, you know, our culture. Then I would be there. You know, I would go out for that kind of thing. So the first silent, I'm sure I saw, well, I know I saw Fractured Flickers when I was very young.
Sure.
But I think the first silent film that I specifically went to see, at least the first one I can remember, was The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. And I think it was very precisely because somebody wrote a review and said, you must see this film. This is essential viewing. And so I said, okay, I've got to see that film. But I had no, you know, I loved photography. I loved writing. I loved movies in a general sense. But I had not studied film history at all until my friend said, hey, I think we could start a documentary film company about movie history. And compared to doing how the P-38 won the war, I thought that was a great idea. I wanted to do that. And so my real education in the silent film era came because of the relationship with the Mary Pickford Foundation and came because as soon as I got into it, I became fascinated with it. It really magnetized me in a way, in that direction. And I've been interested in it ever since. But it's only been since the mid-90s. So I really feel that you and Kevin Brownlow and everybody, you know, so many others who were there from the 70s or 80s on, you know, you had so much, so many wonderful opportunities to meet people and talk to people that I will only learn by reading your books or watching your films.
And yet you've left me in the dust, so...
Hardly.
But the Buddy Rogers one was not really done for commercial release.
No, it wasn't.
So how did Timeline make that leap?
Yeah, the very next one was this thing we called Star Power, the creation of United Artists. And that was done for a very unusual little company that was trying to raise money to launch a some sort of a capital. They were trying to raise capital to launch a venture that would both restore films and make documentaries about classic films. It didn't really work out in the long run, but they had enough money going in that we were able to make a couple of documentaries for them. And then we started to look around at where could we sell a documentary like this for broadcast. And a young gal that we had hired who came from the University of Texas and loved films, had read Barry Paris's biography of Louise Brooks and just fallen head over heels for it. And she said, we've got to try and do this. And I said, okay, great, sounds great. Let's look into what we can do. And we knew about Turner Classic Movies, of course. But we had also found out that Hugh Hefner, the publisher of Playboy magazine, was a great fan of films, of course, and also specifically a great fan of Louise Brooks. So we wrote two letters, one to Hugh Hefner and one to Turner Classic Movies, and mailed them at the same time. And here I have to admit, I did that little thing that sometimes gets done. I wrote to Turner Classic Movies saying, We have approached Mr. Hugh Hefner about helping us to fund this project, and we believe that he may be interested in it. And I wrote to Hugh Hefner. We have approached Turner Classic Movies about funding this project, about partial funding for this project, and we believe they may be interested in it. And we sent both letters out at the same time, and we got incredibly lucky because there was a guy at TCM at the time, Ken Schwab, I believe it was, and he thought, I think the thing he responded to in our letter, we had found somewhere that it was claimed that Louise Brooks, after Charlie Chaplin at least, was the most popular silent film star on the internet because she had a certain hip, you know, sure. Fascination. And there, you know, Thomas Gladys and his wonderful, you know, Louise Brooks Society had, was prominent on the internet at the time. And so that intrigued him. And at the time, TCM wasn't necessarily interested in getting the largest audience they could for a particular documentary. They were interested in getting reviews for their documentaries that would then increase their audience because people would read about it. And so they figured that reviewers wouldn't write about another biography of Marilyn Monroe, but reviewers might write about a biography of somebody like with a cult following like Louise Brooks. So TCM expressed an interest. And we got a call back 2 days after we sent our letter to Hugh Hefner from his private secretary saying, I don't know if he's going to go for this or not, but you caught him at the right time, and he's, you know, this is one of these people he's interested in, Louise Brooks. He just funded the restoration of one of her films at the George Eastman House. And it might happen. And it did. So that became our first documentary for broadcast. It was Louise Brooks, Looking for Lulu. And once again, Roddy McDowell came to place, and he said, you know, could I narrate this one? And I said, well, you know, you're a wonderful person. I'd love to have you narrate something, but it's a woman's story. I'd really like to have a woman narrator. And he said, well, okay. In that case, it's got to be Shirley MacLaine. Because Shirley is fascinated with Louise Brooks. She has a script that is a potential script for a film that she wants to make in which she would play Louise Brooks as an older woman. It had to do with the relationship between Louise Brooks and Kenneth Tynan in their later days, but also it would have, of course, echoed, you know, what was going on in her earlier life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so Shirley's the person. You have to do with Shirley MacLaine. And that was very good for Turner because Turner wanted a celebrity name to be the narrator. And so we approached Shirley MacLaine through her lawyer, and Roddy said, helped us get that initial contact. And we made an agreement. She did it, of course, for a fraction of her usual price because she was interested in the subject. But I never talked to her before I met her. We only talked to the lawyer. And the lawyer set it all up, and it was all agreed. And then we made the documentary, and we got the documentary all finished and ready to be narrated, and called up the lawyer and said, we're ready to do the narration now. And nothing happened. Sat around for 2 weeks, a month, and say, we're ready to do the narration now. Well, yeah, but Shirley's not ready. We'll call you when she's ready. Sat around for another couple of weeks. Well, we're ready to do the narration now. Well, Shirley is in North Carolina on location. She is going to be directing her very first movie as director. And they've got the cast set, and they're just waiting for the final financing. It could come in any day now, any minute now. It could come in. I said, well, that's okay. I mean, it's only going to take us, you know, a day or half a day to do the narration. I can fly to North Carolina. We can. Oh, no. She can't think about it at all until this is all this other stuff is set. I said, well, we've got a deadline with TCM, and we've got to get this done. And I don't know what to do. She said, well, don't, you know, she'll call you. We'll have you call. We'll contact you when she's ready. So I called up Roddy, who, you know, I said, Roddy, I don't know what I'm going to do. He said, well, just tell her to shit or get off the pot. I said, Roddy, I'm not going to tell Shirley MacLaine to shit or get off the pot. He said, well, she's a professional. She'll understand. I said, well, whatever you say, Roddy. And I then, you know, hung up the phone and tried to get my nerve up and come up with the right phrase that may, sure. may not have been exactly that. And 2 hours,
bait, maybe.
2 hours later, I was still trying to figure out exactly what to say when the lawyer called me and said, okay, she's ready to do it. Now, he didn't say, Roddy called me. Roddy never said, I called the lawyer. But I know in my heart what happened. So, in fact, we got it all set up. I flew to North Carolina, and we set up the session. And we gave Shirley, I'd sent the Shirley the script in advance. And she walked in and said, this guy Paris has got it all wrong. I said, I'm sorry, what do you mean? this guy Paris has got it all wrong. He doesn't understand. Louise Brooks was mother obsessed. She was mother obsessed, and her whole life was about dealing with her mother. Well, Louise Brooks did have issues with her mother, certainly. And maybe Shirley is right. But there was no way we could rewrite our script or completely recut our documentary at that point.
Sure.
And so I said, well, we sat down and we talked about 45 minutes or so just about the script, about what did work, what did fit. And she didn't say that anything was wrong with it per se, other than it didn't emphasize this issue with her mother. Everything about her and her mother in there was correct, as far as Shirley was concerned, but the emphasis was just, you know, the emphasis was in the wrong place.
Sure.
In her version. So she got into the recording booth, and she sat down and started to read it. Now, she knew what Louise Brooks had sounded like, and Louise had a very sort of a high-tone attitude towards, you know, in her delivery. If you hear her in recordings of her in later life. And we also had that wonderful Gary Conklin interview, which is another whole story. But to me, at least, I felt I was hearing in addition to what she was saying, felt I was hearing with every sentence that Shirley felt we had got it wrong. So after we'd gone on for about 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and it wasn't changing. Sometimes people work into their, you know, their ways, but she's such a professional, you know. I didn't think this is what she was going to want. So I asked the engineer to turn off the microphone in the booth for a minute and stop recording, and I went into the booth, and I said to her, Shirley, I got to tell you, I think that I can hear that you don't like the script. And she said, okay. We started again, and she gave it a great read. Really beautiful, great, very understanding read. And it was just that little change of attitude. And she was able to do it, even though she thought we had gotten it wrong, which I think was just wonderful. Still one of my favorite narration sessions. And it's not something that it didn't make everybody happy. Some people thought that she was too formal sounding, but she knew, she understood what Louise was about. So that was a wonderful experience all around. And the other wonderful thing about that was getting in touch with finding Gary Conklin and his interview. That in some respects I think made the show, and in fact it was very important to TCM. When we were trying to pitch this thing to TCM, they said, okay, well, what actual footage of Louise Brooks talking do you have? And we knew, of course, about the famous interview with Ricky Leacock, but he had made that into his own film, and he didn't seem like the kind of person who was likely to cooperate with somebody else's film about Louise Brooks. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe he would have been just fine. But he also, that film had gotten a lot of play. He made a fascinating documentary in which she, you know, is on camera a lot. And around the time that we were doing this, we got lucky again. Somebody had written in about to the LA Times, and I guess somewhere, I can't remember whether it was written to the Times or written in the letter to the Times, somebody had said, well, Ricky Leacock's the only person who ever interviewed Louise Brooks on camera. And that's not true. Of course, there was a short interview that Kevin Brownlow did
sure.
that got cut short apparently. And then there was, but in any event, a fellow filmmaker by the name of Gary Conklin, who was based in the San Fernando Valley, wrote back and said, no, this is not true that Ricky Leacock is the only person who ever interviewed Louise Brooks on film. I did. And he had produced a film, a short film for PBS on art in the Weimar Republic. Music, film, writing and everything. It had interviews with Christopher Isherwood and a bunch of other people. And it had an interview with Louise Brooks in it. I'd never seen the film, and it wasn't available. But we were able to find contact information for Gary, and we called him up, and he said, yes, yes, I have 2 hours of Louise Brooks. Yes, absolutely. And I said, great, let's get it out. Oh, well, it's in my garage somewhere. I'll have to go look for it. I said, okay, well, you can look at my film and you can use the footage from my film. So we looked at his film and he had, I think, maybe 5 minutes of Louise Brooks on camera in there, maybe a little bit more. The film itself was only about 25 minutes, I think. It also looked like a 1970s print, 16mm print.
Sure.
You know, it was kind of contrasty and soft and all that, and I wanted to see the original material. And he said, oh yes, I have the original negative in my garage. And so I said, okay, great, let's work on that. And meanwhile, time is going by, and I'll have to get out there one of these days. Oh, please, Gary, come on, let's do it. I'll come over and help you. No problem. No, I'll do it. And eventually he did. So he turned up this stuff. But in the course of that, it went from, well, I have 2 hours of Louise Brooks on camera to, well, I spent 2 hours with Louise Brooks to, you know, he was shooting 16mm film, which is not cheap, you know, we talked about some things, and then when we finally ended up with the final, he had maybe 15 minutes of Louise Brooks that actually was recorded. And even then, he was talking about art in the films in the Weimar culture.
Yeah.
And so when she veered off from that, or when she didn't, or in any event, when she was finishing going on for one of his questions, in some cases he evidently had cut camera but left the Nagra running to record the sound. Because he couldn't afford to spend too much money on the film. So we had the film, the negative, which incidentally, though it was a little faded, we could fix that in post, and it was much nicer looking than the print. And we had the original Nagra tapes, none of which was sunk up, of course. So at our own expense, we did a test transfer of some of that and sent it to Turner to show them what it would be. And fortunately, that sold them on the project. That, along with the fact that Hugh Hefner was paying half the budget, and they would only have to pay half the budget. And they would take a chance on this little, you know, documentary film company that hadn't done anything other than Buddy Rogers. And so in the final analysis, we got it all transferred and we synced it up, and we used some of the stuff that Gary had used, and we used some of the stuff that Gary hadn't used. But stuck in there, something that was only on the audio, was not on film, was a comment that she made about Pabst, in which she said, and I'll get this wrong, but it's something along the lines of the fact, you know, we are all, that she was quoting a writer or a philosopher, and now I'm not remembering who that writer or philosopher was, but he said, we are all lost. Everyone is lost. The difference is that some people know it. And Pabst didn't know he was lost. That was her point there. And I kept trying to figure out where to use this in the film, because the film, our film about Louise Brooks, is not about Pabst being lost. It's essentially about Louise being lost. And I don't know why it took me so long, but right towards the end of the final cut, I finally realized, well, she's talking about everybody. So she's talking about herself as well. And we can cut this in such a way that it's, you know, that we understand she's talking about everybody, and that includes herself. And that became part of the very final moments of the film, right before the final moments of the film. And I, to my mind, still, that incredible statement and in effect, admission makes the story, makes the film. I think, and it was thanks to Gary. He's the one who shot it. You
know. Nice, yeah. That's it's amazing how little footage there is of her. I've never asked Kevin about his footage. I've just seen what's in the Hollywood episode, but. Mm-hmm.
Well, Kevin,
it's only a couple of minutes in
he
that.
He could probably tell you the story better than I can, but as I remember, when he brought out, I think it was The Parade's Gone By, there isn't anything in that book, or whichever book it was he was talking about Clara Bow. And he evidently either got a letter from her, or in any event, when he met her in Rochester, I don't know which, she took him to task for not putting in anything about Clara Bow because she felt Clara Bow was one of the most important actresses of the era.
Sure.
And so partly to sort of make up for that, he went to interview her about Clara Bow for the Clara Bow segment in Hollywood. And that's where that comes from. And she's, you know, in there in the segment. But of course he wanted to interview her about a lot more. And they had just, I don't know if they'd even finished the stuff he wanted to ask about Clara Bow, but apparently at some point, and Kevin, if you're listening, I'm sorry if I get this wrong, but what I remember is that he said that the sound man, after the first few questions, or in any event, at some point in the course of the interview said, hold on, sounds like a toilet in there. And she just suddenly blew up. Somehow that offended her. and she said, all right, that's it. Get out of here. And that was the end of the interview.
Wow.
And,
well, she was certainly a mite prickly. That's,
she was
that's
a,
for sure.
More than a mite prickly, as we found out from her niece.
Yeah.
And, oh God, that's one of the other things I love about that documentary was meeting her relatives in Wichita. I guess it was her brother's, Louise's, oh, now I can't remember who she was. But anyway, there was a niece we met, Rosie Brooks, who, for my money, looks tremendously like Louise Brooks. Mm-hmm. she was just an absolute stunner. And she was very sweet. And we went on our trip to Wichita with Barry Paris, who took us along and helped us tremendously throughout the entire process, gave us contact information for everybody he had interviewed and all this kind of stuff. But we all went to Wichita to meet Louise's two of her relatives. And the niece and the older woman, whose name I'm just forgetting now, I feel terrible, but it was, and Barry said, well, you're going to interview them and, you know, just, you know, do my questions here because you're not going to get anything else out of them. I've gotten everything out of them. I talked to them for years. I grew up knowing them, you know? So, you know, I know everything that they're going to say. And I said, okay, sure. But I never just stick to one set of questions. I always keep trying to, you know, find some more things. I'll start with a set of questions and then I'll just move on to see where they lead. And we had gotten to just about the end of the interview and Rosie told us this sad story about how she had gone, her parents said, go to Rochester, meet your Aunt Louise. And she went to Rochester and showed up, I guess, unannounced. And Louise didn't want to see her. Finally did see her for a little bit, but, you know, was not particularly friendly or anything like that.
Mm.
It was a sad story, but, you know, it also was, you know, it was certainly absolute, you know, Louise could be that way if she was in a bad mood. If she was
sure.
in a good mood, she was great. I mean, at the same time, we talked to John Springer, who said, you know, she was just the best friend in the world once you got to know her. You know, she was an absolute gem once you got to know her. But you had to get to know her. But so we had finished up the interview, and it had been a good interview, but it hadn't been as great as I had hoped it would be. And I kept racking my brain. Now, Louise was a famous letter writer, so everybody knew that she wrote a lot, you know. So I asked, well, okay, did she, you know, she wrote letters. Oh, yeah, well, there was an exchange between her, you know, her brother and and her, yeah, that's true. Okay, I thought, well, what else? I finally said, well, did she ever call the house? And suddenly, a light went on in Rosie's head. And I don't remember exactly when, but I peeked up at Barry, and he hadn't heard this before. She said, yes, actually, she did call the house. I don't remember how old I was, but I must have been 6 or 7 or something, because I had to get up on a little step stool to answer the phone. And I answered the phone, and she said, is Theo there? It was Louise. This is your Aunt Louise. Is Theo there? And I said, not right now, Aunt Louise. She said, nobody loves me. Nobody loves me. And this is, she's talking to a 6-year-old girl on the phone. And little 6-year-old Rosie says, well, I love you, Aunt Louise. She's never met her, of course. How can you say you love me? You don't love me. You don't even know me. What is this all about? And she took her apart. She took apart this little 6-year-old girl on the phone. But actually, it was very touching, because you understand from that she wanted very much to feel loved, and yet couldn't accept it. Couldn't accept it, really, you know, even the sort of basic familial love that you wanted to. It was just, that went from just being, to me at least, that went from being not so much mean, it was just sort of heartbreaking in a way.
Yeah.
And it broke up Rosie, too, at the time. You know, it was a very special moment. And I do remember turning around, and I swear to you that there was a jaw on the floor from Mr. Barry Paris, which was fun. But we had such a good time on that. We went out to Cherryvale, and talked to the historian in Cherryvale, who said, well, you know, we were always more proud of the fact that Vivian Vance came from Cherryvale than Louise Brooks. Louise was a little, you know, but Vivian Vance, now that's important.
Yeah, Louise was nothing but trouble when she was alive, that's for sure.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, she's I love your documentary on her, and it's
still probably that and Theda Bear are my favorites, I think.
Yeah, and I also think Barry's biography of her is one of the best film related biographies I've ever read.
Terrific book.
She's such a strange person, and she really did sabotage her own career every mm-hmm. step of the way, and it's just a really interesting and sad story.
That documentary has a real life beyond TCM. It's no longer being shown on TCM. They signed it up. They got, for their half of the thing, they got, I think it was a 7-year license to broadcast it, which is now up. But it's still available for many years. It was available from Image Entertainment by itself on a DVD with no DVD extras or anything, which I always thought was strange, but that's how they put it out. And it's been picked up by, there are like 2 or 3 different international editions of Pandora's Box that have licensed the documentary to put as a DVD extra on there. And then, of course, Criterion, when they created their wonderful multi-disc set with 4 musical scores of Pandora's Box, they licensed the film to put on there as well. So it's still available on the Criterion set and on several foreign versions. And it's just been, it keeps going and going and going, which is wonderful.
Well, the Theda Bara one, The Girl with the Hungry Eyes, is...
I use the... Fritz Leiber Jr. wrote a short story, a horror story, actually, a supernatural story called The Girl with the Hungry Eyes. And Fritz Leiber Jr., it turns out, had met Theda Bara when he was a little bitty boy, and it was a very unusual character who suggested maybe I should use that title, and I thought, but you know, Theda is really much more womanly. She's not, doesn't have the access of girl, plus Fritz used the title, so I just changed it to The Woman with the Hungry Eyes. A little more mature.
Good switch, yeah.
And
now, that must have been a challenge, because there's so little footage of her. Only a couple of her films survive.
Yeah.
And there's that little bit from Cleopatra, which I think is probably a costume test, don't you?
It certainly looks like it to me. It was done on set, though.
Yeah.
But it has that she's turning around and sort of showing off the costume.
Yeah.
I think you're probably right.
But nevertheless, precious seconds of film, because that's really all we've got of what
There are a lot of misconceptions. Some people say there's only two of her films. Of course, there's three feature films. Some people say there's only half of the short Madame Mystery, but in fact, although it's a terrible print, the whole thing essentially survives. And there is that little, that little tidbit of her from The Stain.
Yes.
Which shows up. And in terms of things of her appearing on camera as a, as a character, that's it. And then there are, of course, her first, middle, and last films. That's A Fool There Was, that middle film that almost no one has ever seen except people who went to CineCon, called East Lynn,
sure.
Based on the very, very famous story. And then the last feature film that she made, The Unchastened Woman, which was for available for quite a long time on a dreadful VHS that was just the lowest resolution thing you ever saw, and fortunately we were able to do a new transfer on it, and from one of the sharpest 16 millimeter prints I've ever seen, and it's got a lot of scratches in it, but it's very sharp. And those exist. There were a couple of newsreels. We also found that she shows up a number of times in the Screen Snapshots series. And you probably know the Screen Snapshots.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And we were able to license one of those. We were only able to find the actual film on one of them. There are others that should exist somewhere. And that was a shot of her at a party at MGM where she's standing next to Norma Talmadge, who is in costume. In 1925 for some, I don't remember which costume feature, and she's dressed up very modern, but it's only, again, like a little snapshot of her moving briefly. And then there's a couple of shots from, it looks like from a newsreel, it looks like she's on a dock somewhere waving. And we found that in two different sources that have two different sections of what appears to be the same shot. And I've seen that happen before, actually, where independent newsreel cameraman will shoot something, and then he'll cut it in half and send one half to one newsreel company and the other half to the other newsreel company. We were able to put it back together again and sort of use it. I think we used it twice, or maybe we did keep it apart and used each part in different places. But she shows up there, and she's very hard to find. You know, there are three, a lot of people think there's only two, there are three radio appearances, all very short. The shortest, which we didn't use, but which is available from the Library of Congress, she does a little quickie bit on Hedda Hopper's radio show. And then there was a Texaco Star Theater, and there was one other radio appearance where she shows up at the end of a radio play and they just do a short interview with her.
It just perfectly nice voice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Of course, she was well done.
But she was well done long before.
Long
that.
Before.
In fact,
talkies,
there's a lot of confusion about that. And you know, I think I'm very proud of our documentary about her because we did a lot of research, particularly a gal who worked for us, Denise Morse, who we hired to be our lead researcher, and she spent a lot of time doing more. I did some, but she did a ton. And she turned up all kinds of stuff, a lot of which added to our information. Because with Theda, you know, she's this legend. And she was meant to be a legend from the very beginning.
Sure.
And they introduced her as a sort of a legend. And so it's very hard, like a lot of these earlier people, to separate fact from fiction. And we got a couple of lessons along the way. And she has two biographers, Eve Golden, who did a wonderful book on her, and a fellow by the name of Ron Giannini, who's a former history teacher based up in Fresno, who did a book on her that was issued by McFarland and came out around the same time as Eve's, and neither of them was aware that the other was working on a book. Fortunately, they're both absolutely great people. They don't feel in competition with each other, and they were both very cooperative in doing the documentary, which was a big help. Eve especially had a huge trove of research that she just sort of like, here, use it. You know. we did find some things that they hadn't found, which was nice. And, of course, all they had been working in the early 90s.
Sure.
You know, and by the time we made this and finished it in 2006, there were options available for research that they didn't have. But we also had the great advantage of being able to sort of launch ourselves from the basis of their groundbreaking work. And so we had that as our foundation, and then we could move on from there. One of the things we found out is, you know, we all sit around and say, oh, well, you know, you can't trust those early stories and those early things. And generally speaking, you can't. But every once in a while, something shows up that people have discounted over the years that turns out to be true. This has little to do with her movie experience, but we turned up this idea that Theta indeed had done what she said she'd done, that both of her biographers, I believe, had discounted, which is that she had gone to Europe as a young actress and spent a time there. And everybody thought, oh, well, she's just, you know, trying to improve her theater sure. credits, which were fairly modest. You know, she started, she left about 1905. She left Cincinnati, I think, and or is it 1903? I'm terrible with dates. Go check the documentary.
Yeah.
But she was in New York for something like 9 years before she hit it big in films, and off and on. And a lot of the time, we don't know what she was doing. There may have been a scrapbook that was lost in a fire. That's what Eve believes. But she said several times that she had gone to Europe and acting to act, and nobody really seemed to believe her. But Denise Morse found the record of her returning from Europe, and we also found, I was surprised at, we also found two versions of the story of her being there, not so much as an actress. She said she went there as part of with a troupe that was going to do Greek drama. And then she ended up in a touring Shakespearean company that did very bad versions of Shakespeare in the provinces somewhere, you know, or, you know, out in the country. And then somehow or other, she ended up in Paris. Now, it seems that while she was in Paris, and maybe before, she got involved with someone in Isadora Duncan's troupe. Probably Isadora Duncan's brother. And we have references to her both from Mary Desty, who wrote her own highly fictionalized,
sure.
You know, biography and story of Isadora Duncan, and from Preston Sturges. Now, it turns out that Preston Sturges was Mary Desty's son.
Yeah.
and so we apparently she got involved with Raymond Duncan. And according to Mary Desty tells a very dramatized story about a future film vampire who was involved with a young man who was very important to Isadora, who Isadora really believed in. You know, she doesn't name any names.
Yeah.
And in this version of the story, you know, this woman was very into spiritualism, and she was doing all kinds of things that really disturbed Raymond's mind, or this young man's mind. And Isadora didn't feel this was a good, healthy influence on him, so she sent him off, evidently, to their school in Russia to manage the school, and didn't tell the young woman until after he had left. And so, according to Mary, Isadora took her to lunch. And on the way to lunch, in the car, she told Theta that she had sent her lover off. And Theta got incredibly angry, according to Mary, stood up in the car and said, "I curse you! I curse your, you know, your children! I, you know, you, and all this stuff." And again, according to Mary, at this very moment, they were passing the spot on the Seine where years later, Isidore's children would both drown. So, and now that is such a fictionalized story by itself, you wouldn't necessarily take it.
Sure.
Yeah. But then you also have Theta's statement that she did go over there and she got stuck in Paris and she came back. And then you have Preston Sturges' story, written at a completely different time, in which he says, he doesn't really refer to Mary's story at all directly, but he does say that for a while he was in Paris, his mother Mary took in this girl, Theta, Theodosia de Coppet, which was her the name she used in almost all of her stage appearances,
sure.
Theodosia DeCoppett, DeCoppett being her mother's maiden name. And Mary had met her at some party, and she had been involved in some sort of intrigue with one of the Duncan family, he says. And so for a few days, apparently, or for some time, I don't know how long, she stayed in his room at night. And he was obviously just old enough that this idea of this rather snaky, sexy, spiritual woman staying in his room at night was something that was of interest to him.
Sure.
And she would stay up late at night and talk to him. And so he has this story in his thing. He says, I kind of hope that maybe, or she said, I can smell you. Like a tiger smell, or a tiger smells its prey. I could smell you. And he said, I rather hope that she would pounce on me, but she never did. And finally, her father came with money for her passage back to New York, and she took off, and she was gone. So it's you put all those three things together, and then you add to it Denise finding the actual record of her returning. On the ship that she returned on, with her name there and her age and all that stuff, and I believe yes, she does. She was in Europe. She was involved with somebody in the Duncan family, and she did have a kind of a wild time. And nobody knew that before.
Yeah, it is sometimes the case that even these outlandish stories have some sort of grain of truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the one thing that I've always wondered about her. Was because, you know, she is Theodosia Goodman from Cincinnati,
mm-hmm.
and then she becomes this exotic, dark vampire. I always thought...
Born in the shadow of the Sphinx.
Yeah, who saw that in her to make that switch? But it sounds like she was a very dramatic person, and it sounds like that she...
I think she had a great deal of fun with that persona.
Yeah. And but I think that the persona came about because they could see that she had that flair for being over dramatic with all these supernatural overtones.
The interest in the supernatural was real.
Yeah.
You know, we have Hedda Hopper, who was with her in one of her stage productions, who talked about her and who said that she you know had this you know, she got everybody in the cast all interested in this stuff because she was, fascinated with that. You do have, of course, things during her career where she supposedly has a crystal ball. And when we talked to Joan Birdsall, who met her when she was just a little girl, Joan remembers a crystal ball. And Joan remembers Theda bringing her over to the crystal ball and saying, look in there. What do you see? And she says, I don't think I see anything. And Theda says, well, I don't really see anything either. But, the interest was there. I think that's real.
Yeah.
And
but you hear the stories about her later in life, and she just seems like the most normal person, very friendly, very funny. And
absolutely.
Our friend Karen Morley, who worked with Braben,
mm-hmm.
so therefore met Theda on occasion, I guess in social occasions.
Right.
Always said she was the most delightful person and would make fun of the vamp character and would
right.
entertain at parties and
yeah.
was just a great gal kind of person.
Right. Well, so did Leitrice Gilbert Fountain, who
yeah.
Talked to her mother or had heard stories from her mother. In fact, hopefully we'll get this documentary, which is now available, I'm going to plug, on Fandor.com for streaming. Hopefully we'll get it out on DVD someday, and we'll be able to put all the DVD extras that we had talked about and prepared, because there's at least one wonderful story that Leitrice Gilbert Fountain tells that we don't have in the documentary because it was just too many stories, there was too much wonderful stuff.
I wanted to ask you about the reenactments in that film.
Mm-hmm.
I'm almost always disgusted by reenactments, and so... I was not disgusted by these. I thought they looked very nice, and I thought they were very appropriate to what you were doing. And I think one of the keys is that you didn't try to take it too far. I mean, you didn't try to act out scenes or anything.
Well, what we have always almost always done. And we did try to do that, act out some scenes for that. I didn't direct it, but it was for our Olive Thomas documentary,
yes,
which I still think was a lot of fun to do, and they ended up in our DVD extras rather than in the body of the documentary. And many people seemed to turn their nose up at them, but I thought it was fun. But generally speaking, and with Theta, since we knew we had a shortage of footage, and I wanted to tell her life story as well, not just her, you know, her about her films, but also about her life story. What I have usually done is I make the film and edit it as thoroughly as I can using photographs and film clips and, you know, interviews. And then I see what's left. That is to say, I see where I've got a black hole. And I don't have anything that really, really can describe this particular story or this part of her life well. And there's nothing that can do it with any kind of authenticity. In other words, I don't, it's not like, oh, I decided to use a reenactment instead of a piece of footage of Theda Bara. Well, that's not the case there. Or I decided to use a reenactment instead of, you know, a piece of impertinent newsreel footage. These are sections for which there is no real good visual illustration. And in the case of Theda Bara, of course, that happens towards the beginning and then again towards the end of her life. Not so much in the middle.
Yeah.
And so then I write and shoot reenactments, that I think are, I hope are, tasteful, that do a good job of illustrating just that moment and nothing more. So I'm not going out and shooting a large batch of things, and I'm not, you know, and in each case it's where there is nothing more authentic that I could use.
Sure.
Other than now, and sometimes you will do a thing, you have got a conversation, say, between Billy Bitzer and Olive Thomas, and you can just go back and forth between, well, let's use a picture of Billy Bitzer here, and then we'll use a picture of Olive Thomas there, and then we'll use a picture of Billy Bitzer here, and then we'll use a picture of Olive Thomas. Well, that gets old after a while.
Sure it does.
So why not use a tasteful, recreation or reenactment for a short moment like that?
Yeah.
And I'm happy with the way they turned out in for the Theda Bara doc. I think we did more of those on Theda Bara than we had done in most of our previous ones. But we had done a few for, even one for Louise Brooks, just one. A couple for Clara Bow and Marion Davies. But very, very limited, and only when there was nothing that we could think of that would be more authentic.
Yeah. Well, we should wind down. So let me ask what your... Are you working on something at the moment? Is something
coming
up?
Well, we've got several things going. I am very excited because I'm hoping within the next 4 to 6 months we'll get a new restoration that I had an insy bit to do with. Several years ago, I was in Prague and in the Czech Republic, and whenever I go there, I try and go by the NFA, the Národní filmový archiv, which is the Czech National Film Archive, and see some American films. Had a great time with film archives and love working with them. And so when we were there, I had heard through several other people, I can't say I'm the person who discovered it, but I had heard that they might have a print of the 1928 version of Ramona. That was a United Artists film directed by Edwin Carew with Dolores mm-hmm. Del Rio and Warner Baxter in the lead roles. And sure enough, they had a print. And so when I was over there, they were kind enough to show it to me. And that was terrifically exciting because I'm fascinated with that story, among other things. And so when I came back, I talked to Mike Michon at the Library of Congress. And Mike was willing to go for it if we could work it out. And so I can't say all I really did was help to coordinate the plan to get the film print, as far as we know, the only surviving film print of this film, back to America to the Library of Congress, where they then have been working on a preservation and restoration of it.
Right.
And it needs some work because we have been... we were unable to find the original English language titles. So I got together a group of experts on Ramona and a native Czech speaker, and we worked out we translated the titles back into English. But if there's anybody out there who knows of a copy of the original English language titles to Ramona, it might not be too late.
Yes.
Library of Congress is working on it right now, and I would love to see that. So that film is going to come out real soon, and right. I have a little bit to do with it, so I'm very happy about that. I'm hoping we can arrange for some kind of nice premiere. The folks at the Ramona Bowl down in Hemet would very much like to use a premiere of that to promote their 90th season of doing the play of Ramona.
I've always meant to go there and see that. I've never done
that. Fascinating thing. Yeah. You should. It's down in Hemet in this wonderful outdoor theater, and it's a truly epic event. Because it's hundreds of people on their Ramona Bowl stage and in the mountains behind, you know.
Yeah.
And it's fun and it's colorful and it's a real important, you know, it's a real part of California history.
Sure.
So in any event, the 1928 Ramona with Dolores del Rio will be premiering somewhere in Los Angeles soon. And then on top of that, we're working on a documentary that has to do with film history but nothing to do with silent film. For some years, my producing partner, Andy Hicks, who is a professional dancer and a former June Taylor dancer from the 60s version of the color version of the Jackie Gleason show, she has always wanted to do a documentary on dance, on some aspect of dance. And several years ago, we got hooked up with a woman, Annette McDonald, and another woman, Marianne Kellogg, who's a professional film and television choreographer, who were working on a documentary on the choreographer and dancer Jack Cole.
Sure.
A very important figure. A lot of people who aren't dancers don't know who he is. I say he was, and this is the cheap version, he was Bob Fosse before there was a Bob Fosse. Because, in essence, to those who are in the know, Jack Cole is viewed either as the father of American jazz dance, or to those who are very, very specific about it, the father of American theatrical jazz dance. The plan that he put together, this incredible sound. And then he started in modern dance with the Dennis Shawn Company.
Mm-hmm.
He worked into doing incredible, groundbreaking ethnic and jazz stuff in nightclubs. From there, he got discovered and came to Hollywood and also around the same time to Broadway and did choreograph films and did choreograph on Broadway, eventually directed some shows on Broadway. But most famously for a lot of us, he became the director of the 50s Bombshells, the choreographer of the 50s Bombshells. He worked with Rita Hayworth. And worked with her on several shows, including, of course, most famously, the little number she does in Gilda.
Yeah.
And worked
put
with
the blame on Mame.
Yep. And then he worked with Betty Grable. He worked with, and then he got involved with Jane Russell and a gal by the name of Marilyn Monroe on a film called,
Gentlemen would Prefer Blondes.
Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, yes. And that was the word that was going in my head was Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend, which is, the number that everybody remembers from that.
Yeah.
And he made Marilyn and Jane, neither of whom were primarily dancers, into these women who moved in music in an incredible, sexy way.
It's such interesting choreography in that film, because I often flippantly call it quasi-stripper choreographer, but they move in such specifically peculiar ways that it's always very interesting to me. It's not
well. Jack's work is almost always very sexy. Sometimes a little too sexy for the period. He did run afoul of some things.
Did he do the French Line with Jane Russell as well?
I don't,
because that's one of the most salacious dances for a production code era.
I'd have to go hunt it down. That name does not stick in my memory. He did Kismet, of course.
Yeah.
Both the film versions of Kismet, and he did the Broadway show Kismet. He did Les Girls, And he did, There's No Business Like Show Business, Heat Wave. He did, essentially, after he worked once with Marilyn, she didn't want to work with any other choreographer.
Yeah.
And she made sure that that was the case. And, from everything I hear, when Jack was on set, Marilyn got on set on time, which was quite an achievement,
I'll say.
I suppose. I get the impression she was a perfectionist, but also had little technique to start with, and very very unsure of herself. And Jack gave her the confidence to be able to do what she could do very, very well. When you're actually up there, when you're actually performing it, there is nobody else to do it. You have to do it.
Sure.
And she did it. So he was very good for her. They had a tremendous relationship, and she would frequently rehearse doing what he was doing in a mirror. He would work behind her. She would work, following him to make sure she didn't forget anything, that everything was there. And I think it was Gene Allen told us a wonderful story that we will be in the documentary, of course, they were on the set with, I think it was George Cukor, I believe, yeah. And Gene Allen was the art director for the film. And they were rehearsing. And they were rehearsing with the camera. And Jack was doing everything behind the camera, and she was doing everything in front of the camera. And they got to a certain point, and as they're watching Marilyn, Cukor and Gene Allen and everybody else is watching Marilyn, not watching Jack, all of a sudden, an incredible pain comes over her face. And she just falls, not falls literally, but she just, just breaks apart. And they don't realize what has happened until they turn around. They see there's an incredible pain on Jack Cole's face because the dolly has run over his foot. So
she was copying everything he did.
She was copying. Well, I guess I'm sure it was sympathetic at that point. But,
oh, man.
Yeah, so it's the Jack Cole doc. We're still searching for funds, and we've been doing a little bit here, a little bit there over the years, but I think this is 2013, where this is going to be the year of Jack Cole.
Good.
I hope. There's a wonderful writer and blogger out there, Deborah Levine, who's done a lot of work on Jack Cole recently. She's been on TCM, and she arranged for a screening of one of his very important films, The I Don't Care Girl, at UCLA, that was tremendously successful. And we're actually expecting, I think we'll be interviewing her very soon.
Great.
We just interviewed Larry Billman. We've interviewed Mitzi Gaynor. We've interviewed Chita Rivera, both of whom worked with him. And we've interviewed a whole slew of other people who worked with him in, with a little less fame, but who really knew him well. And I'm very excited about it. It'd be a good piece.
I'm looking forward to that. That's right up my alley. I'm a great admirer of Cole's. So, that sounds like great stuff. Now, we'll have links to the DVDs that you have available on the website, thecommentarytrack.com. And we'll also post whatever websites and everything.
Yeah, we're building a Jack Cole website right now,
great.
Actually. It'll be ready soon.
Okay. And when it is, we'll let our listeners know. So, Hugh, this has been great. I really have enjoyed this. And
thanks. It's been fun for me, too.
I'm very grateful for you for allowing me to come up here. So let's do it again one of these days.
Absolutely.
Part two.
All right. Oh, you mean I could actually be one of the Frank Thompson second-parters?
Second-parters.
That's just reserved for the really important ones,
Well, that's
I think.
True. That's why I'm saying you can be one.
All right. Well, thanks.
Thanks.
We'll do it.
I hope you enjoyed my talk with Hugh Monroe Neely. That was great fun for me, and we had a swell time and even sat around at his house for a while after that and kept talking, and that's always the sign of a good time, is when the microphones go off and you still just keep going. So we will have Hugh back, believe you me. Let me quickly thank the other people involved in helping make this a good episode of the Commentary Track. My wonderful velvet-voiced wife, Claire McCullough, who does the announcing at the beginning. James Hutchins, who designed my website, both thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. I hope you'll visit both of those.
And, of course, Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand, who wrote my wonderful theme music every week. I am grateful to them for the beauty that they have brought to this podcast. And I only hope that their lush musical sounds help to balance out the harsh gratingness of my voice. Now, please go to my website and order videos and books through the Amazon links. I have some of Hugh's documentaries and so forth on his page. There are also my books and my videos, including White Zombie, which I talked about in the intro. The latest one out, I hope that you will order that through Amazon through my webpage, so I'll get a little kickback. And I also urge you to go to iTunes and leave a good review and a 5-star rating to help bring other people to the site. And if you still want to help me out without spending even a penny of your own, you can go to my Facebook page, the Commentary Track Facebook page, and like it. And I put that in quotes. Did you see me doing air quotes? Like it. Because the more people we can get make aware of this thing, the better off it's going to be, and I would appreciate that. Now, there is a way to support the podcast financially. People have been doing recently. I just got a contribution just about 3 days ago, and I neglected to ask the contributor if he minded if I had said his name on the show, so I will not, but I want to thank him very much for making that contribution. There is a PayPal button on the first page of the Commentary Track site, and it says donate here, and all you have to do is hit it, and you can do a little bit to just help keep this thing afloat, because believe me, at this point, it is a money tsunami, a money waterfall. And is all going out and none coming in. So anything that can happen like that is highly appreciated by me. So I hope you'll consider that. But you don't have to. There's no obligation financially or otherwise to listen to this. Just be here. Tell your friends. Give me a good review. And just let's keep this thing rolling. So you've got another good guest coming up next week. And I hope you'll be back. And in the meantime, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.